From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report for the 31st day of May, 2022. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson. He's at L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. We'll hear an interview from the Illinois Nutrient Loss Reduction Podcast that previews, really, tomorrow's field day that'll be held on Keith Gorham's farm in Rock Island County. You can still register for that. Details online at Will. Ag.org, and we'll hear also about the weather forecast. Don Day will join us from Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, July corn today settled at $7.53. It was 23¾ cents lower. December down 18½ cents at $7.11. July bean 16.83¼, 49 cents lower. The November new crop at 15.09½, down 34½ cents. Bean meal futures were down $17.50. The bean oil $1.65 lower. Soft red winter wheat down to 70-cent limit at $10.87½. Wayne Nelson now joins us from L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana, to talk about the first trading day of the summer, well, at least after Memorial Day. It's not been a good one, Wayne. What happened?
Well, you know, we come in, and like you say, a lot of times we'll see a real trend established as we come back from a three-day weekend. And basically, it's old news but new news today. The Russians sort of saying that they might be able to work with Turkey to broker a deal to have safe passage for some exports out of Ukraine here, along with some of the ideas that they might be able to ship some of their ships out, and by doing this would get cheaper freight insurance because it's been, you know, really bad as the high insurance rates for any of the boats coming out of Russia. And if they could broker this deal, that could maybe lower their insurance for both grain out of the Ukraine and out of Russia. And that, of course, if we add the Russian and Ukraine grain back in, our prices are too high.
It was about both the Black Sea and the Sea of Azov. So both of those trying to open ports up so that Russia could export grain and that Ukraine could export grain. Turkey involved in the middle of it. We'll have to watch and see how that progresses. The United Nations or UN also talking with both Russia, Turkey, and all of the rest of the Western world about this war in Ukraine, and we'll see how all of that lays out over the next several days, I would think. But today, it really made the price of grain and oil seeds go down simply because, as you said, there would be so much more in it. Any reason for farmers to react at all to this?
You know, I guess I'm going to say if you held through all of today and haven't done anything, I'm probably going to say hang on and see what comes next, because the last time we sold off for this reason, why then they threw some more restrictions in that we would have to cut some of their other restrictions as far as oil into the world, as far as other stuff, and what we're trying to bottleneck Russia on for starting this war. I think if we do see this fall apart, why we'll see a rebound at that point in time. If this thing keeps moving along, okay, maybe we're a little late to the party, I guess, you know, because it will damage the prices a little more if this does go through.
Speaking of a little late to the party, Senator O'Heven out of North Dakota, talking late last week and this week, DTN had a story on this, about changing some of the rules. Well, not really changing the rules, but adding some income in for those who would be taking Prevent Plant, especially in North Dakota. They were only 20% corn planted, I think, last week, so that they would continue to plant corn, though I expect when we see tomorrow afternoon's crop progress report, it may show some real progress, actual progress in North Dakota. What are the expectations, in fact, nationally for that report tomorrow afternoon?
Well, you know, I mean, along the way, we're looking at the guesstimates for 85% of the corn to be planted, 67% of the beans to be planted. You know, last week we were 72 on the corn, 50 on the beans. The average is 83 to 89 on the corn and 62 to 71. So, in So, I mean, along the way for planning here, we're not terrible as we go, but we are looking at the possibility of up to 2 million acres coming out of the Dakotas and prevent plant that way. Will they try to extend it to not have any penalty for being after the late planting date, hold it there for an extra week trying to get some more planted? I don't know. It's awful hard to change the crop insurance rules on some of that. That would be sort of a big thing and a big change that I think the odds are more against it than for it. It's more of a 60 against 44 for something to try to change something like that. I think that they've still got time to plant beans up there if they want to, but some of that ground is just too wet and probably will go prevent plant this year.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate you taking your time with me today.
Thank you, Todd.
That's Wayne Nelson. He's with L&M Commodities. Last week, we completed episode 47 of the Illinois Nutrient Loss Reduction Podcast. It includes an interview with Keith Gorham. You can find it online right now at willag.org. Keith is a farmer from Rock Island County, Illinois, near the Quad Cities. And tomorrow, we'll be hosting a field day. And you're invited to come. It's free. Registration is still available. You can find that on our website, too, at willag.org. He's up to some really interesting things related to beef cattle production, row crop production, cover crops, and so much more. I'll let him tell you a little bit about it. Here's the interview from the podcast. There's more of that podcast, by the way. You can find it again on willag.org, and I'll tell you how to register for the field day as we wrap up our conversation with Keith Gorham.
My name is Keith Gorham. We farm in western Rock Island County. It's right along the banks of the Mississippi River, so we have a very diverse, different types of soil. We have heavy river bottom gumbo all the way to clay knobs, sand knobs, and timber soil. So it's very diverse in the soil types.
I assume that means you have a pretty diverse set of conservation practices that you might use in the operation as well.
Yes, yes. It's definitely a challenge from one year to the next. But I'm fourth generation at this, so we've kind of learned over the generations farming the same ground that what works and what doesn't. But I've been no-till for about 15 years. We started using the regenerative, what now they call regenerative ag principles, back in 2015.
What does that mean?
Regenerative ag, to those that aren't familiar with it, is basically, in layman's terms, it's going back to the old ways. It's going back to letting nature make the decisions for you, as long as you can observe and try to manipulate nature as much as you can, but not using chemical or commercial inputs any more than you have to.
So what kinds of things do you do?
We've been transitioning more and more acres into this regenerative every year. I guess the main thing, since we were obviously already no-till, we started using some single species cover crops, which cereal rye is kind of the go-to there. We started using that, and then we started looking into more multi-species, because the more you study about this regenerative ag movement, anything in a monoculture is not going to get you to where you want to be, especially with the disease and the insect pressure we're having nowadays, let alone the nutrients, the fertilizers. Then we started integrating our cattle into those covers instead of just grazing corn stalks like you'd done years past. In 2019, we had a lot of prevent plant ground being in the river bottoms. That gave us a chance to try a whole bunch of different cocktail mixtures of different species plants all in the same year. So that was kind of the big eye-opener year.
And then in 20 and 21, were you able to follow up, and do you fall graze then some of those?
Yeah, we fall graze some. And also, to keep this at scale, because us as well as most people, they can't graze all of their acres. And that's the biggest thing. Anybody could probably do this on their home farm close to the pastures or so forth. But to really scale this up, you got to be able to do it without livestock as well. So we started just trying different things, and we found that the diversity in the plants is that's the key to all this.
By diversity, do you mean you're using ryegrass and brassicas and other sorts of things?
Yeah. Yep. Rye, your grasses, your brassicas, a lot of legumes. What we're trying to achieve is getting to zero inputs as far as commercial fertilizer goes. We're down to one herbicide pass. We've got like 40 some, yeah, almost 50 acres in zero nitrogen now for corn crop. I mean, we've eliminated P and K. Our tests come back, and we use the Haney test for most of our soil testing now. Comes back, I don't know if we'll ever have to put P and K on this ground again by using these practices with the cover crops.
I'm interested in the fall grazing just a bit more. Do you interseed the crops to get them started early, or do you wait until you've harvested?
Well, what we've done is, instead of just being a corn bean rotation, we've introduced small grains. We started moving our rotation more heavily to the wheat, the winter wheat, so to speak. So that way our cash crop is out of the ground, it's harvested, and we have time for these multi-species cocktail mixes to actually get a firm hold. And then that opens you up to grazing. And actually, I think these small seeds have been probably our most profitable acres, because we'd harvest the wheat, sell the wheat, and then, you know, bale the straw. Maybe a lot of these acres now, it's not a good idea to bale the straw if you want to increase your carbon and organic matter. So we'd introduce these, seed these cocktail mixes in, and then graze in the fall. So that's got a value right there as well.
Do you need to use rotational grazing when you do that?
Yeah, we play with a lot of different things. We're doing some rotational. We're doing some of what they call mob grazing, where you bring an excessive amount of animals onto a 1 or 2 or 3 acre paddock and graze them for a matter of, you know, 24 hours and move them. So that's kind of the neatest thing we've been doing lately, is doing the mob grazing. And we have one farm that we're kind of using that as our experimental on that. Just by what you see when you get into this regenerative ag stuff, you'll see a lot of people doing that. And that really works. The animals actually trample. And that's what I meant earlier by going back to nature. It kind of replicates what the buffalo did. The same thing we're doing by moving them into a small area and then moving them.
You don't have a compaction problem?
No, we don't. There's really the compaction at that time of the year, you wouldn't have to worry about it as much either.
Because you have heaving and frosting during the winter months to take care of part of that.
Yes. In addition to that, we've always got, you know, something growing in the ground, and we're not grazing it down to, you know, a golf course. I like to say, we're not grazing it down to your front lawn. They're actually wasting 2/3 of it, and only taking the top third is what the goal is.
How many beef cattle can you manage on an acre in this form?
Oh, there's different opinions on that. Some people say 100,000 pounds per acre. I mean, these are some of the guys that are really, really doing it on an extreme scale. We're only running 30 head, you know, on that acre.
I'm interested not only in the conservation and regenerative methods you're using, but also the integrated pest management, that idea that you're scouting. What kinds of things do you incorporate?
Well, that's probably the neatest thing we've seen. But once we started getting our mixes to where we had, you know, even three species going, we started seeing, I think it was after the third year, we started seeing the visual change. We're seeing more beneficial insects. I took off on a chase trying to study the beneficials, because I always heard that there was 1,700 good insects for every one bad. And we started seeing stuff that I haven't seen since I was a kid here along the river, was dragonflies. We started seeing a slew of dragonflies after our third year. The ground beetles, which I don't know if I just never paid attention, but they are there in droves now in our cover crops. And come to find out, they're a beneficial insect that's actually predator to the ones that we're putting all these chemicals and pesticides and everything out to get. Our disease pressure is little to none as well. I mean, there was a learning curve there. The first couple of years, it wasn't all rosy, but once we got off of that, after year three, then you started seeing these changes.
It's all well and good, but unless you've got a market or it actually works as a commodity, it doesn't really mean that you can farm this way. Have you found a market for your products?
Yeah, I mean, we're no different than anybody else. Actually, our non-GMO corn is going to an inland elevator that it's just going in with the mix of the other corn. We also have an outlet locally that's a alcohol, grain alcohol producer. Now they pay a premium, a 20 to 40 cent premium on that, which is all well and good, but that isn't the reason why we did it. We feed cattle ourselves and also sell some freezer beef. And I don't know, it's a good talking point to be able to sell non-GMO fed, grain fed type beef. But no, the actual non-GMO premium wise, that isn't the reason why we did it. We just wanted to go back and try to get away from all of the I guess one guy said when we first started studying this, wouldn't you rather sign the backs of all these checks instead of the front? Instead of buying, we'd like to keep more of that profit for ourselves.
And do you find that's the case?
Yes, actually, we've studied that, and back, what was it, 2020, our corn crop, we were off a little bit on our yield compared to our conventional rest of the farm, and we were $82 an acre more profitable on our zero input. Now on zero input, we're still having to do one herbicide pass. We're not calling ourselves organic or any of those terms, but we are seeing that we only have to hit it with one herbicide pass. So we've eliminated our N, we've eliminated our P, eliminated our K, and now we've cut a herbicide pass out of it.
What do you think is the most important lesson you've learned through the process?
Oh, there's a lot of lessons learned, some of them the hard way, some of them the easy way. I guess it still comes back to diversity. When we first started, no-till, then rye, we learned that the diversity is the key to it. We have to be able to get that cover crop out there. We have to be able to manage that cover crop, whether it be roller crimp, which we're just starting to do the roller crimping this year. But that's the biggest lesson learned, is that it comes back to the diversity. You can't just do one thing and come in the house and sit, make yourself feel really good about what you've done because it's the buzzword for that year. You have to be committed to it. It's not an easy thing to start out with, and but it is scalable if you can take it to a level, over our 400 or 500 acres of grain. We're at, I don't know, about 20, 25% right now that's fully off the chemical system.
And finally, what advice do you have for other farmers who are interested in adding conservation practices with a focus on integrated pest management or IPM?
I guess the first thing is if you're doing no-till now and you'd like to do a cover crop, or maybe you're doing a cover crop like cereal rye, is get comfortable with the rye. And maybe with a legume like clover, which is easy, then try to expand into multiple species. Get comfortable as quickly as you can with them, and you'll see the differences quicker than what we did. Adding small grains, if you can, especially on a year like this where wheat is, high price, there's definitely profit in it. And even harvest some of that seed. Say if you have some rye out there, harvest some of that, and that saves you money on your next year's cover crop. But we have definitely become much more profitable, even with a slight yield drag on corn. Our beans yields have gone up, but we're still more profitable. I guess that's the biggest advice I got is take it easy, don't go too fast, but try to get there as soon as you can, if that makes any sense.
That's Keith Gorham. I talked with him for the Illinois Nutrient Loss Reduction Podcast. You can hear the whole of episode 47 on our website right now at willag.org. Look in the podcast tab and you'll find the Illinois Nutrient Loss Reduction Podcast, or you can just look for it on your favorite podcast application. Keith, by the way, will be hosting tomorrow in Rock Island County, Illinois. That's the northwestern corner of the state, a field day. It starts at 10 o'clock. There's still time to register. Details are on our website, again, willag.org. Just scroll down and you'll find a link to get yourself registered for the field day tomorrow at Keith Gorham's farm near Illinois City, Illinois. It's a Tuesday afternoon. Don Day is here from Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. Find him online at dayweather.com. Hey, Don, thank you for being with us. Start in the northwestern part of the Corn Belt, maybe up into part of the Canadian prairies, that is. They've been really pretty wet, delayed in their planting season. Really delayed. I'm wondering if things will dry out for them.
Well, at least here in the short term, and this would be especially true for Manitoba, they're still going to have some wet weather to get through here over the next 48 hours. Pretty good low that came through the Northern Rockies that brought 2 to 3 feet of snow to parts of Yellowstone National Park is bringing rain to those areas now. Now, I do see a trend later this week and into the weekend that will be drier. Saskatchewan, Alberta, they're going to be a little bit drier here in the short term, but the trend up there is still cool and still wet, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah, soybeans, oil seeds, rapeseed, sunflower, wheat, all important in those areas. When you get into the United States, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Minnesota, what do conditions look like for them this week?
Well, as we go through the next 4 to 5 days, just a little bit of shower activity. They are going to see also some warmer temperatures. So for the next, let's say, 5 or 6 days ahead, the prospects for drier conditions are certainly there. I do expect, however, rain and thunderstorm activity to return to the Dakotas, the northern and central parts of Minnesota. So there's going to be a little bit of a drier period and a bit of a warmer period, but getting wet again next week.
Do those rainfalls sweep through the rest of the Corn Belt as well?
Well, it looks like for the latter part of the forecast, so as we get on to, let's say, this weekend and into early next week, the answer is yes. We do see, especially the northern and northwestern areas of the Corn Belt, seeing a thunderstorm activity, a pattern that's very typical for June, to where temperatures are going to be mild, getting warm, staying consistently warmer. But little disturbances about every, let's say, 2 days are going to trigger areas of showers and thunderstorms that will pretty much be Corn Belt-wide.
So meteorologists, I believe, think about the summer beginning now, not until the 21st of June is the actual beginning. Have you thought about what this summer will look like across the Corn Belt?
Well, I tell you, there are some real conflicting signals, and I will tell you there are some real conflicting forecasts out there. There are some forecasts that are pretty warm and drier for some of the central and west central areas of the United States. Some other computer models and other folks are thinking otherwise. I will say that from what I'm seeing, as we get into June, July, and August, the heart of the summer season, that for a lot of the Midwest and Corn Belt, I think conditions are going to be ending up really close to average. Average temperatures, average precipitation, which is going to equate towards good growing conditions. Although, I think the front end of summer, June, especially the first half of June, is likely going to end up not being terribly warm. Temperatures close to average, a little bit below. So it's not going to be a rip snorting hot start to summer. If we're going to get heat, it's going to come mid to late in the year.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
That, of course, is Don Day. He's with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. Find him online at dayweather.com. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world. Find us online. Listen to us on demand at willag.org, willag.org. The theme music for the Closing Market Report is written and performed by Logan County, Illinois farmer Tim Gleason. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.